Speak. So I'm going to start with some kind of basic review stuff. I'm sure it's very familiar to a lot of people in the audience, but at least it'll get us all on the same page. So remember, a non-local game is kind of a scenario where we have two players, Ellis and Bob, and a referee. And the referee chooses inputs X and Y for Ellis and Bob and sends out, sends these to Ellis and Bob, who reply with outputs A and B, and they return these to the referee, and the referee decides either Ellis and Bob win or they lose together. So Ellis and Bob know the winning conditions in advance. They can cooperate, but the main thing that makes them this difficult for them to play is that they can't communicate while the game is in progress, hence the term non-local game. And it's important to say that in this case, I'm talking about all the communication is classical. So the input questions are X and Y are classical, and the outputs A and B are classical. And winning or losing is classical as well. So, so suppose the game is played many times over, and we can, so that means there's some input distribution for the inputs. So to an outside observer, Alice and Bob's strategy for this game would be described just by what can be observed by their behavior. So that would mean that we have some probability that they output A and B on inputs X and Y. And that's really all the outside observer can see. So we call this the correlation matrix of the strategy. Okay. And the value of the game is since Alice and Bob can't they can't communicate while the game is in progress, they maybe ahead of time have to come up with some strategy that they're going to follow. And the value of the game, let's say on a given strategy, could be their winning probability, given that they're observed to output A and B with probability P, A, B on inputs X, Y. And then if we optimize, if we take the maximum over all possible strategies, without saying yet what strategies are, then that would be called the value of the game. So the kind of the point of the talk is to talk about what are the possible strategies that Alice and Bob might use. So of course, a very famous story for the classical side of this, they can use randomness maybe to flip a coin. So they each output, let's say Alice outputs A with probability A of AX, and Bob outputs B with probability B of BY. And so in that case, the correlation matrix would be just the product of the two probabilities. And then, of course, on the quantum side, if Alice and Bob share an entangled state, then Bell's theorem is the thing that says that they can do better with an entangled state than they can do with strategies of this form. Okay, so here's the real question is, how do we describe quantum strategies? So this is kind of a wall of text, but there's some, I guess I want to hang on to this actually. So there's some things in here, the reason this is up here, this is all really basic stuff. There's some things I want to focus on, and in particular this one. So so basically what we're saying here, actually look at this first, right? So this is what quantum mechanics should tell us. That we have our probability of outputting A and B on X, Y is given by, so Alice and Bob are going to have some shared quantum state, and they're going to measure this state, and the measurement operators say are MXA and NYB. And when they measure this state, we've got the normal expectation value here for the results of the measurement. But crucially, they each, because they can't communicate, they each have their own local Hilbert space, and the way we describe the joint, the composite system, is by taking the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces. So so if we follow that set of axioms, then this is what we're going to get for, this is the way we describe quantum strategies. Now, this is a quantum foundation seminar, so I guess this is where people might start to object or agree or whatever. But if you want to speak up to ask questions or make comments, please do. So we can basically, if we're interested in this set of, what can Alice and Bob do, we can just write down the set of all possible correlation matrices. So that's what this is. It's just a set of all possible PABXYs, where the rules here are exactly what were on the previous page. I've specialized to projective measurements, but that's kind of without loss of generality. Also, I've decided to choose finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So if you were looking at that, that might be your first objection. Why do we choose finite dimensional Hilbert spaces there? Well, maybe we might have some reason to think that finite dimensional Hilbert spaces are all we need. But we could say, well, let me try and, I really think we should use infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, so we could allow that as well. And we get a different set of correlations. Same kind of flavor, but so we call these, just give them different names. We've got CQ for the finite dimensional ones, CQS for the infinite dimensional ones. And then we could do something else. We could say, well, what about the idea that we could have limits of the finite dimensional ones? So for instance, so why would we want to think about limits? Like imagine we might have some models, but they're approaching some kind of ideal behavior. Maybe we want to throw the kind of ideal thing that happens in the limit in as a possible quantum correlation as well. So that gives us a third set, which we call CQA. So just the closure of the set of CQ.
When you say limit, you mean limit in the sense of D going to infinity?
No, limit. So in this thing, although I've said that these are finite dimensional, there's no limit on the bounds of the. So already here, we've taken a union across all possible finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. But here, we're just taking limits strictly in the sense of numerical limits. We've got a finite, since. All the question sets are finite. We basically here have a finite list of numbers, and then we're just going to take a limit in the normal topology. Yeah. So kind of the limits of what we could see in terms of what our observable outcomes are. But of course, the reason that this set. So here's what we know. Let me say this. Here's what we know about the relations between these sets. So that's why I haven't added a limits of the infinite dimensional ones here. Because it turns out that the closure of CQS is equal to the closure of CQ. So we get the same thing whether we take the limits of the infinite or finite dimensional ones. But we don't know whether any of these inclusions here are strict at all. So it's possible that when we look at finite dimensional correlations, as we allow larger and larger dimension, we could have a sequence of correlations that's approaching some point but never, never converges to something that's actually represented with a finite dimensional Hilbert space. Okay. So it's, if you really want to say, like, what are the set of Alice and Bob strategies, there might be a little bit of a mystery here. Which set of correlations should we pick? But it's not that big of a mystery. All these things kind of have the same flavor. So, but the problem is there's actually another option that we could take. And this is the set of commuting correlations that have commuting operator models. So here, what we do is we say, Alice and Bob each have an algebra of observables. They act on a common Hilbert space. But rather than saying that Alice and Bob have a local Hilbert space and these things, the joint Hilbert space is a tensor product. This joint Hilbert space, this global Hilbert space, has no tensor product structure. All we require Alice and Bob's algebras to do is that they have to commute. So in other words, if we have an operator in Alice's algebra and an operator in Bob's algebra, then AB has to equal BA. And so algebraic quantum field theory, for instance, uses this as an axiom. If you have two space-like separated points, and you look at the algebra of observables, then the kind of a composite algebra, the composite system has to have these two subalgebras be commuted. So this gives us another set of correlations, exactly the defined in exactly the same way as before. But instead of putting it in a tensor product here, we just take the product of the observables. Right? So taking a product of observables is fine as long as they commute. Right, so it's still a well-defined observable there. And then we have our commuting restriction instead of having them each act on a local Hilbert space. So it's pretty clear, or should be clear, I guess, that that all these correlation sets I've defined before sit inside the quantum commuting correlations. I mean, if you have things on local Hilbert spaces, then the algebras definitely commute. But what's not clear is how this new set, CQC, actually relates to the previous correlation sets. So I don't know how much to say about the history of this problem, but we call all these problems basically, they all come under the umbrella of Cyrilson's problem. And so you kind of get a Cyrilson problem here for every CQ or CQS or CQA, is it equal to CQC? Each one of those is kind of a Cyrilson problem. The reason it's kind of ambiguous as to which one is really Cyrilson's problem is that Cyrilson originally claimed as a theorem, he was one of the first people to kind of study these correlation sets and point them out as something important we should study. And so what he said is you can define a set of correlations. Remember, CQS was our tensor product with infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, or possibly infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And he also said you could define these with commuting operators, but they're the same. Okay, so he kind of claimed as a theorem that CQS and CQC were the same, and then, you know, well, then it doesn't matter how we define them, and we can just kind of proceed from there. And then it was only later that he was asked to provide a proof for this theorem, and he realized, well, he didn't have a proof, and so he stated as a problem whether or not CQS is equal to CQC. He also pointed out this other one, whether or not CQA is equal to CQC. So remember, CQA is our closure of the correlation sets. So we don't know if these correlation sets, because, for instance, for finite dimensional models, the dimensions could be increasing. We don't know if it's closed. And it's kind of when you start to think about it, you realize immediately that while we're interested in all of these problems, really what we'd like to know is this, what I call the, I also have inherited this terminology from Vern Paulsen at Waterloo, the weak Cyrilson problem, whether or not CQA is equal to CQC. That's kind of like the most interesting of the bunch, because what we're asking there, we've got, so I didn't mention, but all of these sets are convex. So we've got two closed convex sets, and then we want to know if, they're different. What we're really asking, is there a separating hyperplane between the two? So if we're talking about a separating hyperplane between the two, we're asking, is there a Bell inequality, or we should call it maybe a Cyrilson inequality, that separates CQA from CQC? In other words, is there a Bell inequality that would, or you know, a Bell experiment we could do that would allow us to distinguish tensor product models from commuting operator models? So for that reason, we're really most interested, I would say, in this weak Cyrilson problem. The other version is not uninteresting, however. This strong Cyrilson in particular, CQ equals CQC, I think has attracted the attention of a lot of people studying non-local games, in particular because it seems very intuitive that we care most of the time about finite dimensional models, and it seems very odd that there could be correlations that we'd write down, or maybe it seems odd at first, that there are correlations that we could write down that aren't represented by finite dimensional models. So I think maybe a lot of people, when they first encountered this problem, actually, or certainly this was my experience about 10 years ago when I first read the problem statement, to try and actually prove that these two sets were equal. Try and show that for every correlation with a commuting operator model, you can write down some finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. It's not an unreasonable thing to guess, because you've only got finite many measurements that you can make, and finitely many measurement outcomes. Okay, so what do we know about this? Well, we know basically two things, and one of the things is what I want to talk about today. So one is that this weak Cyrilson that we really care about seems to be a very hard problem. So it's equivalent to something called the Kahn embedding problem in functional analysis. This is a theorem of Ozawa, although I have to mention Tobias and Yanga, Navasquez, Perez Garcia, Paluzuelas, Schultz, and Werner kind of were the first people to really point out this idea that these two things should be equivalent, that they had the same kind of flavor. And
I think it was at the same time.
Your paper and.
At the same time.
Yes, yeah. So the other thing is that we can finally say something about separating these correlation sets, which is that the quantum, this CQS, A question somebody should ask is, what does the QS stand for? So quantum spatial, because it's a tensor product. It's what the functional analysts call these things. So this quantum spatial set of correlations is actually different than the quantum commuting correlations. So we can actually find correlations in the commuting operator model, which are not represented by any tensor product model, whether finite dimensional or infinite dimensional. Okay. So depending on time, I always like to put a little extra slides in this. So I want to talk about some other formulations of this problem. Like, I think this formulation comparing the commuting operator model and the tensor product model is pretty interesting. If we're interested in something like axioms of quantum mechanics, then we really would like to know, should we have it, or should our axiom system be one with this commuting operator axiom, or should it be one with a tensor product axiom? But there's actually a couple other ways we can think about this problem as well that kind of really highlight the issues that come up. And they're not due to me. This one is due to Nevesquez, Perez Garcia, and Villanueva. And you have to kind of use your imagination a bit on this one. But imagine that Alice and Bob are doing, they're doing a Bell experiment. And of course, that means they're separated. So Alice is somewhere off in space, and Bob is sitting around doing his side of the measurement statistic, the measurements and so on that he needs to do. And Bob gets bored. Now, Bob is not a very high-minded person. He doesn't care about modeling the state of the universe. All he wants to do is model his local system. And he's convinced he can do it by using the standard axioms of quantum mechanics. And so what Bob has access to at that time, of course, is just his. So Alice and Bob in their joint measurements are kind of keeping track of everything. And they're going to find this P, A, B, X, Y. But all Bob has access to is P, B, Y, his local measurement statistics. And so what he does to model his local measurement statistics is he needs to find some measurement operators and some density matrix that give him the observed statistics. Now, what he knows, though, is that when Alice is going to come back, she's going to laugh at him because, you know, she's going to say, well, every time that I measured X and outputted A, that should be like a, you know, put those measurements that you did in a separate category. You know, those is kind of a, that's different from the experiments when I outputted, when I chose measurement setting X prime and got output A prime. And so Bob wants to actually come up, let's say, with models that will be able to recreate the full joint measurement statistics. So in other words, Bob, as I said, doesn't care about trying to model the whole joint state of the system. He just wants to model his local measurement statistics. But he does say, OK, I'll concede one thing to Alice, who wants to build a model of the joint system, that when Alice does measurement X and gets output A, that will mean that my local state should be reflected by, you know, should be captured by some state which reflects what Alice did. OK, so there's some rho XA. And some the measurements, of course, don't change depending on what Alice did, because what Bob's doing is the same every time. There should be some state rho XA that allows Bob to recover the joint measurement statistics here. So here's the question. Can Bob build a model of his local statistics which is consistent with Alice's observed inputs and outputs? So the answer, if and only if, there are these density matrices rho xa. And then when you put all of these density matrices together, they have to give a single density matrix, which is independent of what Alice did, what Alice's choice of x was. It's still just the rho to model Bob's local system, though. Okay. So here's what Nevesquez et al. Proved. So can Bob build a model of his local statistics which are consistent with Alice's observed inputs and outputs? Well, if and only if there are these rho xas. And this turns out to be true if and only if this joint correlation actually belongs to the this tensor product with possibly infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces model. So we have something that says Bob can do this if and only if this correlation belongs to the CQS set. Now, so in some sense, the theorem I mentioned before that says CQC is different from CQS, That's saying that if commuting operator is the true picture of the universe somehow, Alice could create correlations which would defeat Bob's, you know, efforts to get ahead of the game here. Bob would never be able to create local models of a system that are consistent with what Alice is doing. But somebody who's more of a mathematician and could come along and say, well, you're using the wrong model of a state. You know, in C-star algebras, when we talk about a state on a C-star algebra, we don't talk about these density matrices. We talk about linear functionals. So a state to a C-star algebra is a linear functional with some properties. Basically, this linear functional has to preserve, so it has to send the identity to 1. I think this b to h should be ignored there. I think that's supposed to be b of h to c. So it's supposed to take in, you know, something from your C-star algebra and output a number. That's what a linear functional should do. And it has to be, the number should be positive on every positive operator. Okay. So here's an example of a state, something that says take your operator A, multiply it by the density matrix, and take the trace. Okay, but there are examples of states that don't come from density matrices in this way. So what if Bob uses general states instead of density matrices? Well, in this case, we can ask the same question, right? So now, if it's up here, what we'd want would be states kind of fxa, which depend only on what Alice did, such that when we sum them up, we get some state which is independent of what Alice did. We could rewrite the whole thing out mathematically in the same way. And what we get is that if Bob uses these general states, then he can build a model of his local statistics that are consistent with what Alice did, if and only if this correlation matrix belongs to CQC, the quantum commuting correlations. So what we get out of this is a C-star algebraist could be confronted with somebody maybe doing quantum mechanics. They could say, you know, what's the point of these general states you keep talking about? Well, there are general states that can't be represented by density matrices, so we have to use this general formulation of states in general. Well, but can this ever matter? Well, there are Bell scenarios where it can matter. So just in very simple Bell scenarios, maybe very simple, they're subjective, but in things with finite number of measurement settings and finite outputs, we can actually see the difference between general states and density matrices in terms of the modeling power of Bob to model only his local system, not even the joint system. So that's one formulation of these Cyrilson problems. Here's another one I want to mention. This one is due to Ozawa, although I have to say I learned of this through a paper of Matt Kudrone and Tomas Vidic. This one, imagine you're faced with somebody who's even more hard-headed than Bob, who we had before, who didn't want to think about joint systems at all. This person says, I believe only in finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And in my opinion, it's an idealization to talk about composite subsystems. Those don't exist. They represent something ideal. There's always some interaction between systems. It might be very, very small. You know, they're on other sides of the universe, but nonetheless, there could be some very small interaction that's going on there. Well, how could we represent a system like that? Well, we start with the finite dimensional Hilbert space, we throw that in there, and we don't get to make this Hilbert space be a tensor product, but we can enforce the commuting operator, we can't enforce the commuting operator condition. We can say, this is what I want to say, that the correlator looks like this. If we think about what we're doing with that, we're saying that neither Alice nor Bob have the ability to know which measurement was made first. Okay, so we're choosing a correlator of this form. That already guarantees that these correlations will be non-signaling. It's kind of interesting. We've got some model of systems that are interacting, but because of the knowledge of Alice and Bob, assumption we're putting on them is kind of human actors. We get a non-signaling correlation set. And then to get this limited interaction condition, we say that the commutator between the observables has to be bounded by some epsilon. So that seems like a natural kind of set of correlations to pick. So Ozawa's theorem says that this CQC is the intersection across all of these epsilon CQCs as epsilon goes to 0. So in other words, a correlation lies in the commuting operator model. if and only if, for every epsilon, so you can make epsilon as small as you want. You can say, you know, this represents kind of an ideal correlation where I can limit the interactions between Alice and Bob as much as I want. But when I put that limit, I put that epsilon when I write epsilon down, I can always find a correlation on a finite dimensional Hilbert space that achieves this correlation. Of course, the dimension might have to get bigger and bigger and bigger as epsilon gets smaller.
So the CQC of epsilon also contains stuff with complex value probabilities, and then have small imaginary value?
Yeah, depending on how you define it, it might. That's right. Yeah, but you could just say, and also this has to be real if you really want to get
that you
can get rid of those. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to understand why the expression is psi max n b y. So if n and m don't commute, then I can imagine that the statistics could be different depending on which one I measure first. So I would have imagined doing something like, well, let's write down the probabilities I would get if I measured n first and then m second. So I just use the standard projection postulate for n, and then I measure m. Or, you know, the vice versa. But I don't see how either of those would give me that expression. So I didn't quite follow when you said this is the situation where you don't know which came first.
Yeah, so this is maybe not... this is my thinking about it, and I'm not sure that this is the best way to think about it. But it also relates to what Tobias was just saying. So first of all, imagine that these are all real, right? So that I have this is equal to this. And then, yeah, is that visible here?
Almost.
I've just flipped the order inside. Yeah. In other words, if I was to take if I take the conjugate of that, right, I get this in reverse because these are self-adjoint. So, but if it's real, which is not it's actually probably a restriction that should be put on this to think of them as probabilities. Maybe even real and positive, right? Then I don't have to put the bar over that. And so what I really could be doing is I could be thinking of this as the observable mxa nyb plus nyb mxa averaged.
That still seems different from my perspective to the probability of getting outcomes A and B when you measure n first and m second.
So the way I think about this guy, I mean, it's a little, it's still not quite right because these are, it's not necessarily positive anymore, right? So you want to correct this to an actual positive operator. So it maybe makes the most sense in the case where you think of these as observables with plus or minus eigenvalues. In that context, it makes the most sense. But what I see here is that we have the observable where we're doing the joint measurement. We've got two measurements, and we do both of them like simultaneously. And what simultaneously means there is that we have no knowledge over which one is performed first. Like we've got two people sitting down to make the measurement, and somehow in the actual system, one happens first, you know, just because of very small perturbations. One will happen first, and then the other one will happen second, but we don't know which one is which.
So maybe I'm mistaken, but I would have thought that if that's the description of the experiment, then the right operator to appear there would be 1 half NMN plus 1 half MNM.
Yeah, that would take care of the positive stuff. So
it's just from the projection postulate, you know, if I ask what's the probability of getting the y outcome of n followed by the x outcome of n, it should be nmn appearing in there.
With assuming there are projective measurements.
Yes.
Otherwise, we should have a half in there.
We're using standard projection postulate.
What I'm going to do we should really figure that out for sure, but I'm going to say that it doesn't matter because of the fact that they almost commute, that you're always going to get something that's close to the to that anyway.
Okay.
Yep. But we should actually figure out and make sure that that doesn't actually give a different answer. Because the bad thing would be if you did that and it gave you a different answer than this. Yep. I could also say that it's not my reformulation, but I feel like that would be cheating a little bit. Actually, I like this formulation quite a lot, so. Yeah. Okay. Oh, did I? I missed my chance to say the conclusion of what this thing is. So, we could ask if something has finite, like remember we were talking about finite dimensional models again, if we have these finite dimensional limited interaction models for every epsilon, does it have an actual finite dimensional model? And the answer is no, because this set is all quantum commuting correlations, and this gives us, and we know that's different than CQS. Okay. So, okay, so that's Cyrilson's problem. It's kind of interesting with non-local games, and it has to be pointed out that this is not the only fundamental question about non-local games we don't know the answer to. We study and we use them all over the place, but mathematically, they're mysteries in a lot of ways. And I think the biggest mystery is actually this question. For just this is my mathematical bias, right? If I write down a non-local game, can I compute the optimal value? Whether it's over strategies, it should always be over a closed set when I do an optimization problem. I mean, the answer isn't going to depend on whether, if I'm taking a soup, it's not going to depend on whether I'm taking the closure or not. But so if I restrict to the two sets, the two closed sets here, CQA and CQC, either, I think, optimization question we don't know all the answers to. So of course, the one we're most interested in is this first one here, CQA. Can we find the optimal value over finite dimensional strategies, but where the dimension is unbounded? If question two had an affirmative answer here, if everything you get in the limit of finite dimensional strategies actually has a representation as a finite dimensional model, then that would help quite a bit because we could just search through finite dimensional models. Here's a similar type of question to question two. Imagine I give you a correlation and I tell you it's finite dimensional, but I don't tell you what the dimension is. Can you actually compute in a reasonable way, not in something where you start looking for the actual representative of this thing dimension by dimension, but where you just look at the correlation and go, oh yeah, you'll need to use Hilbert spaces of dimension 1,000 to get that correlation. We don't have any way of putting upper bounds on what we'd need. So these are all kind of mysteries. So again, there's just a few things we do know about these questions. One is this NPA hierarchy that if you want to compute a game, a value of a game, you've probably run into before. It says that we can actually find a sequence of semi-definite programming problems which converge in value to the quantum commuting value. So we kind of have, it's pretty interesting, we have two algorithms that we can try and use to compute different things. So let's say we're trying to compute omega QA, the value over finite dimensional strategies. We can do that by taking, we can just optimize over CD for fixed dimension D, and then we can look what happens when we increase the dimension. And we'll get something that is approaching this value from below. And then this NPA hierarchy gives us something, SDP problems, which approach this commuting operator model value. And they actually approach it from above. So there's kind of an interesting duality that's going on between our two ways that we can actually compute, try and compute values of games. Sorry, this got right pushed over to the side. So let me, it says optimize over CD. We can get omega QA from below, and if we use the SDPs, we can get omega QC from above. That's one of the reasons why we care about this, one of the many reasons we care about this con embedding, which is if these two values were equal, we'd have a way to kind of compute the value of it. We go from below, and we go from above, and we wait until we're within epsilon from below and above. Now, even if we were to disprove con embedding, we still wouldn't know the answer to that question, whether we can compute either of these quantities within epsilon. But it turns out, this is the other result I want to talk about, that we do have some limits on what we can compute. So if we want to compute the commuting operator value, then it's undecidable to determine if it's less than 1. So if we think about what happens with this NPA hierarchy, we're approaching from above. So the first level of the hierarchy, maybe we compute it and we get out value 1. We get out value 1. We get out value 1 as we're increasing the level of the hierarchy. And we have what this is it's undecidable to tell if we're ever going to stop in this hierarchy. We keep computing, but we'll never be able to tell if the value really is 1 or if we're going to drop below at some point. So no other limits. So although I'm kind of talking about two results, really there are more mysteries than results still about these questions. Okay. So I mentioned two theorems. So in this latter part of the talk, what I want to tell you is basically a little bit about how we prove these things. Not to do the proof, but to answer a question which you should probably have looking at these, which is how do these two results, which look very different, get into the same talk? So the fact is that they both come from a more general result, which is basically pure group theory. So I want to tell you a little bit about how we can reduce both of these questions to group theory. So this comes through a particular type of linear system game, a particular type of non-local game, which we're calling linear system games. And they generalize some of the oldest examples of non-local games, or also, I should say, contextuality results, namely the Merman Paris Magic Square and the other game introduced by, forget if it was Merman or Paris who introduced the other example. But it's a very natural class of games based around a linear system. So imagine you give me a linear system, AX equals B over Z2. So I can turn this into a game in the following way. What I do is I want to check that the system is actually satisfiable. But I don't want to look at more than one equation at once. So I give Alice an equation, and I ask her to output a value for each of the variables in the equation. Now, some of the values in the equation, some of the variables are going to have coefficient 0 in that equation. So I don't care about what those values are. It's kind of helpful to have an actual linear system in front of me. So x1 plus x2 is equal to 0, and x2 plus x5 is equal to 1. Can these go up?
Yes, there's a push button.
Button, gotcha. OK, I'll figure that out some other time. Presumably, this is viewable here. So if I give Alice the first equation, she would have to output x1 and x2. And if I give Alice the second equation, she would have to output a value for x2 and x5. So and in both cases, she's required to make these, to output satisfying assignments of the equation. So she has to make something that satisfies two variables whose sum is 0 or two variables whose sum is 1, depending on which. This is a very boring example, but it illustrates what Alice has to do. Now, of course, Alice can cheat on doing this, right? Even if the linear system isn't satisfiable, she can actually say, well, it's easy to make one equation satisfiable at a time. So how do we actually check that Alice isn't cheating? Well, we use a second player. A computer scientist would say a prover. And we use that so we need to verify what Alice is doing. We don't need to check the whole equation. Instead, we just give that person a variable. And we ask, we ask Bob to output an assignment for that variable, and then they win. So keep in mind when thinking about this that Bob doesn't know what equation Alice got. So if they have a consistent assignment, if there is some solution to this linear system, Bob can just output the value of a variable in that solution, and Alice can output the value for all the variables coming from that solution, and they'll always be consistent. But so in general, they win, you know, if the two values agree, or if Bob's variable didn't show up in Alice's equation. So the question is, can Alice and Bob cheat if they have quantum entanglement? And the answer is yes, they can. That's exactly the Merman magic square example. So if you take your square, 3x3 square, and you put a variable in each box, and then you ask that the sum of the rows always be even, and that the sum of the columns, actually you can do the sum of the columns be always be odd. You'll get a linear system with 6 equations, 9 variables, and unsatisfiable, but it turns out with entanglement, Alice and Bob can actually win this game perfectly. So what happens in general? Well, it comes out to a very nice piece of math, which is really due to Richard Cleave and Rajat Mittal. So imagine we write down these linear systems, but multiplicatively. So if I want to write down a linear system multiplicatively, that means I want to change 0 and 1 to plus and minus 1. And a variable, therefore, rather than being the condition we want to put on that variable is that it squares to 1. And then we can write down our linear equations multiplicatively. So when we take the product over these variables, we get either plus or minus 1, depending on what bi is. And so far, if I just make all my variables commute, I've just written a linear equation. It's entirely equivalent. What if I want to talk about a quantum version of the linear system? Well, I should make the variables non-commutative. That's clear. But then the other thing I should do is I should make some of the variables commute. And that's because if I want to think about measuring those variables, like if I want to check an equation like x1 plus x2 equal to 0, now it's x1 times x2 equals the identity, then I'm going to have to measure x1 and x2 simultaneously. So what I do is I say that if xj and xk both appear in the ith equation, then make them commute. So it's worth appreciating, taking a moment to appreciate this definition, because it's a very natural thing coming from linear algebra and quantum mechanics. And we have so many kind of fundamental things that come from linear algebra, and we don't get new ones very often. Of course, the reason that, we'll get to this, but the reason that we think of so many of the things in linear algebra as being fundamental is that it's easy to make computations with them. And so really, this would be a fundamental object in that sense, if and only if this is something that I can teach undergrads how to do row reduction with, right? So that should be the question in the back of the mind, back of our minds. How well is this object behaved? But leaving that question for a moment, what can we do with this? Well, it turns out the game has a perfect strategy. So this is a theorem of Richard and Rajat. It has a perfect strategy in this tensor product model if and only if this linear system has written multiplicatively and so on, has a quantum solution. That means a solution where we plug in observables, self-adjoint operators, in other words, on a finite dimensional Hilbert space into these equations in a way that satisfies all the equations. And then what Richard and Li Lu and I were able to show is that if we want to talk about quantum commuting, so perfect strategies in CQC, that happens if and only if we have a quantum solution in general. So if we allow infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, that's the same thing as just having some observables we can plug into this equation on some Hilbert space. Okay. Now, what we should notice looking at these equations when we've written them multiplicatively is that we've almost written down equations for a group. The only thing that keeps us from being a group here like I'm thinking of a finitely presented group with generators x1 up to xn. The only thing is this pesky minus 1. Groups don't have minus 1s. So how do we get rid of that? Well, we can just substitute that out for some element we call j. And then we have a group. And so we call this the solution group of the system. So if we rephrase this result with the solution group, we can say that this this game G has a perfect strategy over CQS if and only if this group has a finite dimensional representation where J is not equal to 1. The not equal to 1 is the same thing as requiring J equal to minus 1, because to make J really behave like a scalar, we add on some relations. We make J commute with everything. And so if J is not equal to 1, it has to have a minus 1 eigenspace. And we can just restrict to that eigenspace and get us a finite dimensional representation where J really is minus 1. But the reason I've written it like this is because for the second part, we want to say we can do exactly the same thing. We can say G has a perfect strategy in CQC if and only if J, if and only if gamma has a finite dimensional representation, sorry, cross out finite dimensional, if and only if gamma has a representation with J not equal to 1. That's the only difference between these two things, cross out finite dimensional there. But having a representation with J not equal to 1 is the same thing as J being not equal to the identity in the group, because the group always acts on itself. So what we get for this quantum commuting side is that we just get an instance of the word problem. If we want to know if it has a perfect strategy or not, we need to tell whether or not J is equal to the identity in gamma. Okay. So remember this thing, it's undecidable to tell if a group has a perfect strategy. Well, we've reduced this to an instance of the word problem. So that means the word problem for groups is undecidable. That means that this is undecidable. Well, not exactly, right? Not all word problems for groups are undecidable. Like if I want to tell if two things are equal in a finite group, I could just enumerate the whole group multiplication table. And I can always answer the word problem for finite groups. So I mentioned this problem of figuring out if this group is tractable. Well, one thing we might ask is, does this group have a solvable word problem? Can we always tell if we have a perfect strategy in CQC? And there's some reason to think that it actually would have a solvable word problem. I mean, enough that I worked on it for about a year to try and show that this group is well behaved. And the reason is we force so many generators to commute. Like, imagine you are allowed to write down an arbitrary group. So you can write down any generators you want and any relations you want. But when you do, somebody says, you have to make, every time you write down a relation, you have to make all the generators in that relation commute with each other. So think about writing down the relations for the symmetric group, for instance. So S3 is generated by A and B, which squares the identity. And then one relation, AB cubed, equals the identity. So if you think, if you have to make A and B commute in that relation because you wrote them down in the same relation together, that's the same thing as just saying that A times B is the identity, or in other words, A equals B. So what you get in the end is just Z2 out of that. It's very destructive to have to say, every time you write down a relation, make all the variables in the relation commute. So nonetheless, despite these solution groups having this property, we can actually get any finitely presented group we want embedded in a solution group. So that's the kind of general theorem that allows us to prove these other two theorems I mentioned. So so all this says is that given any finitely presented group, and we also care about this J element quite a lot, so it would be nice if we could carry J through. So let's suppose we're given some central element of the group which squares to the identity, then we can actually find an injective group homomorphism into some solution group where we send the J we started with to the J of our solution group. So the end result of that, for instance, is that this is the word problem for this J element in solution groups is not a special case of the word problem for general groups. It's equivalent to the word problem for general groups.
And you also want that homomorphism is explicitly computable from
Yes, it is actually, and we'll do an example of how to compute it. Yeah, for computability, you do need that. Okay, so how do we get the thing that says that there are commuting operator correlations that aren't tensor product correlations? Well, now that we make this connection to arbitrary finitely presented groups, we can use the fact that there's you know, many different groups known with all kinds of different different properties. And one of the properties that we can find examples of groups with this property is groups that are non-residually finite. So what that means is, suppose we have an element of our group. We can always find a representation where that element is not acting by the identity. But to be residually finite, we have to be able to find a finite dimensional representation where that group acts by the identity. So non-residually finite means that there's an element of the group such that that group element goes to the identity in every finite dimensional representation. So this sounds very esoteric, but in fact, quite, you know, you don't have to look very hard to find examples of these. So here's one example. It's got only four relations and four generators. And it says that if I conjugate, say, B by A, I get B squared, C by B, I get C squared, and I go around in a circle until I get A conjugated by D equals A squared. So by itself, conjugating like a group element which is similar to its, or a matrix which is similar to its square, is a little bit uncommon. I don't expect that to, you know, to encounter that when I'm doing examples for undergraduates, let's say. But it can happen. But when we put these four relations together, what we get is a group where, in fact, if you try and write down, you know, a finite set of matrices satisfying these relations, the only matrices you can pick are just the identity matrices for every generator. This thing has no non-trivial finite dimensional representations. OK, so how do we show that this strong Cyrilson problem is false? So what we can do is we have to figure out a way to make J be the identity in every finite dimensional representation. And we can do that kind of with just some standard group theory tricks. So for instance, if we start with a group which is non-residually finite, the element G being the one that's the identity in everything, we can add a relation that basically says that we've got a new generator, and this generator, the commutator of this generator with G is this J0, where J0 is a central element which squares to the identity. Okay, and then we embed this in a solution group. And the end result of that is, so this in this group G, if we think about this group G, if we take a finite dimensional representation of this group, then little g is always the identity in that representation. And that means that J0 will always be the identity because x commutes with the identity. So the commutator there is the identity. So we get this group G where J0 is always the identity in every finite dimensional representation. But if we think about a representation of a solution group containing G, then that will be a representation of big G. And therefore, J0 has to go to the identity. But J0 mapped to J in this inclusion. So J for the solution group will also go to the identity. So remember, having a perfect, so do I have this? Yes, I do. Right. So our theorem was we have a perfect strategy in CQS, if and only if there's a finite dimensional representation with J not equal to the identity. And we've constructed a group where J is always the identity on finite dimensional representations, but J is not equal to the identity in the whole group. So we get a perfect strategy in CQC, but not a perfect strategy in CQS. So the final thing to answer is, how do we do this embedding? Like Tobias's question, is this inclusion always computable? So I'm not going to go so far as to say the whole recipe explicitly, of course. But it turns out, because we're dealing with linear systems over Z2, that I can draw the solution to this. So what I need to do is, if you give me a group, I need to tell you how to get a linear system so that I can embed that group in the solution group of the linear system. So if I want to draw a linear system, I've got a matrix, an M by N matrix filled with zeros and ones. So I should think of that as a hypergraph. So I'm going to think of the equations as being vertices and the edges as being the variables of my equation. And a hyper edge will be incident with a vertex if and only if there's a one in the appropriate spot of the matrix. Okay, so here's an example of how we do this kind of construction. So I start with a group. For this to actually work with the recipe I'm given, you have to start with a group generated by things that square to the identity. So these are kind of standard relations. And then we have two other relations, xy, xz equals the identity, and xu, vu equals the identity. And so I've drawn a hypergraph. So anything that looks like a normal edge is just a normal edge. Its incidence is two vertices. And everything that's drawn otherwise, like this is a hyper edge incident to one vertex. This is a hyper edge incident to three vertices. So remember, vertices represent equations, and edges represent variables. So you read this as a linear system as follows. Let's pick an equation, for instance, this one up here. This equation has three variables, one here, and one here. And so the equation would be that this variable plus this variable plus this variable is equal to 0 as I've written it. And you might wonder what happened to the b. The b should be some vertex labels that I've left out of this for simplicity, but they go into the picture as well. So in this case, we don't need a b either. It's only when we deal with the j's that we need a b, basically. So you see that our original variables in the group survive here. And our homomorphism just sends the x of this group to the x of the corresponding solution group. So remember, the solution group had a variable for every variable of the linear system. And so the x, z, y, v, and u will show up as variables in the linear system. And finally, where did this hypergraph come from? Well, if I take one of these relations, I can draw it like which one? The first one there, my x, y, x, z. Okay, and I claim I should draw it like this. I should start with a vertex, and then I should have a bunch of half edges coming out of it, such that the half edges are labeled by the elements of the relation. And so what you do is, if you picture a relation like this, then you need to blow it up to a wagon wheel. So starting from this, so if you look at this picture here, if you look around the outside perimeter, we've got this internal wagon wheel shape, spokes and so on. But around the perimeter, we have x, z, x, y. So that's our first relation. And then this one is u, v, u, x, which is it's this relation red starting from the second one and then looping around. So in general, it's not actually that hard to construct a linear system. It creates very large linear systems. And in fact, I've left out some pre-processing that you would have to do for a general group, actually quite a lot of pre-processing. But for a group which is kind of already in a nice form, this is what you do. OK, so I'll stop there.
Think about these sorts of general questions, especially the difference between tensor product structure and taking the commutative operator structure in a sort of generalized probability theory framework. So this is GPT framework, so it's a complex property space, which is more general than quantum theory. And they've been set up very well in the case of sort of tensor product structure. I don't know if anyone's ever thought about this in the context of something more like the commutative operators.
Yeah, you have the advantage of me, and I'm not familiar with the generalized probability theory, but I'm happy to try and figure it out afterwards. Yeah. Yeah.
And the wagon wheel embedding, is it with the relevant property that each one of these external variables? It's kind of adjacent to its own region.
Yes.
It's kind of separated by the spokes from the other ones.
Yes, it's very relevant. And what happens is, there's a calculus of pictures which you might be familiar with, but it takes a little bit too long to explain in general. But if you imagine that if you can draw kind of a picture whose boundary edges are you know, labeled in a certain way, that that will be a relation in your group. Like I could also then add onto this x, y, x, z. Here's another picture now with two vertices. And it says that x, y, y, x, z, z, well, that's clearly a relation, but this picture says that it's a relation in the group. Okay, so if I was to do the following, here's a way to make something where I can, I need something where I can get pictures of my original relations that I started with. So I could do this as a, I could do this as a hypergraph where these are just things connected to one vertex out here. But here's a picture then of the relation in this, you know, in the solution group for x, y, x, z. But I can't use this because I could also construct the following picture by making x go through the middle. So I could cancel the x out, and I would get a relation that says y equals z. So what? So what this is doing is it's saying, don't let any cancellations out. So you could also ask, could you do something similar? Like rather than having to build a whole wagon wheel, maybe I could just add an edge there. And maybe that would be enough. And I don't know the answer if that's enough or not. The wagon wheel is something that has enough symmetry that I can prove that it has the right property. But there's no reason to think that this doesn't already do the job. So, yeah.
So on the slide where you said that that particular solution group you had in finite dimensions only had trivial instances.
Yeah, just a group, actually, not a solution group.
Oh, right.
Oops, too far. This one.
Right. So, I'm thinking of that as kind of an intuition behind why there's a gap between the finite dimensional and the commuting case. Is that, am I thinking correctly? That?
Yes, except to qualify the gap, that we don't know if there's an actual numerical gap, just that the inclusion is strict. But it still could be that the closure of the finite dimensional case is the quantum commuting. But the, yeah, this is exactly right. So because there are groups that have infinite dimensional representations but not finite dimensional representations, then when you put that together with this theorem and the fact that you can embed, you know, that there is solution groups that contain any group that you want, that gives you the.
So have you thought at all about, suppose for a moment that there were a gap.
An actual numerical gap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think it would be possible to see this in some physical situation? So is it the case that this would be something that you could experimentally demonstrate the need for infinite dimensional representations for some experiment, or?
Well, if there was a gap, then hypothetically, the mathematician would not have any objection to such an experiment being done, but you still have to find a system that would have, you know, would be represented by a commuting operator model, but not be represented by a tensor product model. And all the people I've talked to that have any kind of a physics bent at all seem to think this is ridiculous, that everything that we know is described by tensor product models, and that we'll never have something that's described by commuting operator models but not by tensor product models as an actual physical system. In light of that, you can ask, is there any point of, you know, even thinking about the difference? I mean, I guess one point is that we never know what's going to happen in the future. Maybe there could be something that does have a commuting operator description, some, thing we discover in 100 years or something. But the other side of it, of course, is that I find more interesting is the mathematical side. What mathematical questions can we answer when we write down, you know, we write down a problem in quantum mechanics? It's really a mathematical problem. When can we answer that problem or not? That's the kind of thing that Tobias is going to talk about next week, I think. Something a little more in that vein. So I think that aspect of it is actually quite practical. But this, that aspect of it is there actually an experiment that could be done to demonstrate the two are different? Well, theoretically, but what what is the experiment? It seems like a bit of science fiction to try and figure that out. So
you could also say that if indeed there were a gap, then regardless of what anybody thinks concerning the need for quantum commuting systems, if somebody were to go and then violate the Searlson type bound that represented that gap, that would prove that, okay, our theories have to incorporate this.
That's right. So if Alice and Bob were playing in a casino that was set up to allow tensor product models but not allow commuting, didn't take the commuting operator models into account when they set the odds for the payoffs, and they became, billionaires, then we might have to believe them that the commuting operator models were really the right description of reality. Yeah, that's right.
And this whether there really is a numerical gap or not.
That's equivalent to Kahn embedding.
Okay.
So, yeah. It also has that most of the cases actually also have a group theory expression, not all of Kahn embedding, but a lot of the cases we care about. So I've run into a lot of people in quantum information who might say that Kahn embedding is likely to be true, but from polling people who do deal more with the group theory side, I think people think it's more likely to be false. And there are, basically what it comes down to is, for every finitely presented group, can you write down a set of matrices that, given a finitely presented group and epsilon, can you write down a set of matrices that satisfies those relations up to epsilon, finite dimensional matrices? For every finitely presented group you're given. And I think the thinking is in particular that this, nobody knows how to do that for this group here. So, for instance, so if you could, this is something to do on an airplane or something, just try and find families of matrices that satisfy those relations up to epsilon would make a major advance in our understanding of the problem, I think. So if anybody has some kind of inclination for that, be a good problem to work on. Yeah.
So going all the way back to the beginning of this talk, you define these different sets, the CQ, the CQA, and so on. So are you assuming a fixed size for the alphabets?
Yep. So, well, it depends what you mean. So for any given set, I'm assuming a fixed size, but then you could take a union over all of them if you want. Yeah.
And does that cause any issue with defining the closure?
It would define, so you would want to take the union over all the closures, then we need to find the closure if you did that. Yeah, so for taking the closure, it's fixed. Fixed question sets and fixed output sets. Yeah. Another question is, how big do you need the question sets to be to actually get the separation? So something like 600 and 400 if you follow everything through. The output sets are small. 8 is the largest, but so if you want, you could imagine that everything's bounded by 1,000. All the question sets are at most 1,000 for everything in the talk.
No more questions. Let's find the speaker again.